Crow Armstrong deep to right, and that's going to tie up the game. Pete Crow Armstrong in Flushing puts a dent in the team that traded him away. His 10th home run of the year to tie up this game at one.
Yes, I was just about to say he had done a really good job of keeping the ball just below the zone or just above the zone. And that one he left in the zone. And the one thing about PCA is his damage in the zone is incredible.
My bias was from how we saw him in Boston in the draft. I thought there was a lot of fourth outfielder risk with him. Loved the defense. The unknown was the bat. He was ranked our fifth highest prospect according to MLB Pipeline at the time. So he wasn't regarded as even one of our top prospects. And I'd say his value, industry value, reflected that. Obviously, in hindsight, that's a bad long-term decision. The big league players produced. But if you look at Pete Crow Armstrong as a just purely as an asset, obviously we sold lower than his peak value. But I give the player a ton of credit for that. He's since, by my estimate, tripled his industry value since that trade, which is unbelievable for him. I just tip my hat to him and say that that's great for him. Long term, objectively, wasn't a good decision for the Mets. I didn't feel great about it. There weren't a lot of people in the room that were jumping up and down to do that trade. And our job is to get it right more often than we get it wrong. I got that one wrong.
It's another edition of the Talking Mets podcast here on this Sunday, May 11th, 2025. Of course, I'm your host, Mike Silva. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. You get me on X at TalkingMetsNoG and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. NoG, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. You can get me on Instagram, TalkingMetsNoG, and don't forget the newsletter, substack.com/@TalkingMetsNoG. And I want to thank the good folks from the Fansided Podcasting Network for supporting this show. Welcome to another edition of the Talking Mets Podcast. Happy Mother's Day, early Mets 12 p.m. game. Let me ask you this. I know the whole Roku situation bothers a lot of people. Another app you have to download. At least you had Gary Cohen on the broadcast. But how would you feel if all Sunday games start at noon? Get started early, be done by about 2:30, 3 o'clock. You have the rest of the day ahead of you. I know if you're at home, I mean, it gives you enough time to get some of your chores done in the morning before the ball game. And then you have your whole day ahead of you. I don't know. I mean, it's an interesting concept. I know getting to the ballpark, and the Mets had over 41,000 here on this Sunday. That might be a little challenging. Got to get up a little earlier. Some people have religious services that they partake in, whatever it may be on a Sunday. Weekends are always a time to catch up, and the more time you can get to catch up and do things that you have to do to raise a family, we know that. But anyway, I just was thinking about that. I was like, it's actually kind of nice. The game's over. The whole day's ahead of you. Get some good radio going. And that's going to be the last for a while, because I know that the next couple of Sundays, the Mets, they're going to be going to the Bronx next week. First taste of the Subway Series. Subway Series Part 1. Mets swept the Yankees last year, so let's see if they can keep the streak going. And then they play the Dodgers on Sunday Night Baseball the week after. So a lot of Sunday Night Baseball. So this will be one of these rare Talking Mets on a Sunday that we can get to you on a Sunday at a normal hour. We'll see how the schedule goes. But anyway, another weekend, Mets play the best offense in baseball. They held them to an average of a little over 3 runs a game, 10 runs throughout the series. The Mets pitching continues to look sustainable, and they're in first place, and the first of what is going to be a month of tests. The Subway Series is always a barometer. I have a feeling this year the Subway Series is going to take on maybe that salt, you know, that vinegar, spit and vinegar that we saw back, not in the 90s, but we've been talking about for a while, and this will be something more to examine later in the week, but we've been talking about it for a while that it's lack juice, the Mets-Yankees Subway Series. Well, I have a feeling Juan Soto switching sides might be the igniter of bringing back some of those old juices, those old flames of dislike I hate to use the word hate because it's so strong dislike that each of these fan bases have for each other, especially I think now Yankee fans and what have you. So there'll be a lot of tests. Dodgers, the 96 Bulls of baseball coming to town the week after. So it will be interesting. But the homecoming, and we'll start there, was Pete Crow Armstrong today. And before I get even into that, I have to tell you, being a basketball fan, enjoying the Mets and what they're doing, the crowds were great throughout, you know, Friday night, loud crowd, really loud crowd today. Listening, I know things didn't go well at the Garden on Saturday afternoon, but, you know, a couple of big Knicks wins up in Boston this past week. And for the first time in a really, really long time, this time of the year, especially in the late 90s, 98, 99, 2000, you know, even going back to 97 when the Subway Series first started to, you know, take on a life, it was always a really fun time of the year. You had the NBA playoffs, you had the Knicks making deep runs, you had big Knicks wins, you had the Mets and the baseball season just starting, but it was always an early season Subway Series. It was one of those first early tests. You know, who could forget in 99, Matt Franco and the Matt Franco walk-off, or 98 and, you know, that Yankee team coming in, into Shea Stadium, or the inaugural Subway Series. But there was always a, even 2000, you know, with the, you know, the Knicks making a run and you know, the Subway Series that eventually led to the real Subway Series later in the year. There was always that feel in the air. And somebody put up on X this week, how crazy would it get this town if the Yankees won a championship again? They haven't won one since 2009. The Mets won and the Knicks won, you know, or the Knicks won. Which would be craziest? They didn't even put the NFL. They didn't put any of the hockey teams in, like the Rangers. And I have to think that the Knicks and the Mets, it's close. I think the Knicks might be crazier because outside of a few small pocket of Brooklyn Nets fans, and I say very few small pocket of Brooklyn Nets fans, the city's all behind the Knicks, and it's been so long. They haven't won since 1973. Now, it's been a long time for the Mets, 1986. I think it'd be wild for the Mets. I think it'd be a great story. But it was an interesting question, but I can tell you the energy that you're feeling from these hungry fan bases, the Knicks fan base, the Mets fan base, it's a fun thing to see, and who knows what's going to happen. A lot will be told about the Knicks in the coming 24 to 48 to 72 hours, whether this run is a thing or they're about to get snuffed and short-circuited by a champion. I'm not here to give you NBA analysis, but I will tell you this, that for the first time in a long time, you're feeling that energy. Like, things are going in the right direction. Things are functional with the Mets. Nothing's perfect, but things are headed in the right direction, and you feel that they have a shot, just like everybody, all the top contenders, to do something special. And the same thing with the Knicks. The Knicks may not be right there at the top. They may be the next rung down of teams that are championship contenders, but they're not far off. And you're actually seeing a lot of growth of that team right before your eyes, and we'll see where it takes you. But I haven't had this kind of feeling at this time of the year about my teams probably since 2000, 2001, around there. It's been a long time. Either the Mets have been really good, and the Mets have had some good years since the Knicks went into the doldrums. The Knicks have had two decades of dysfunction and mismanagement. They started to percolate over the last two or three years, but I think the last year it's become a little bit more serious. And I think when the Knicks were making their run last year, it was in the midst of the Mets having that awful May, so you really didn't have a chance to have that vibe or that feeling. But now this week you have big Knicks games at the Garden. You have the Mets, obviously, are continuing their homestand against the Pirates. The Yankees are, you know, the Mets are going to Yankee Stadium. You'll have a Subway Series next week. And you may have a game six and seven coming up on the, you know, sandwiching those Subway Series games for the Knicks and Celtics. So it'll be an interesting week. It was just some kind of a sidebar note. But I know the Mets won two out of three. And you heard, you know, the intro. So what I'm going to do today, I thought it was appropriate. So anyone who is a subscriber to Talking Mets Beyond the Mic, substack.com/@TalkingMetsNoG. And if you weren't, it was a free preview, you know, totally free. It was out there for everybody to consume, the prospect list. And the reason I did that is I want to give everybody the feel of what we do here. And it won't be like that forever. You know, obviously we want to reward those who pay for premium content, but I thought it was important to share that with everybody to give them an idea. Hey, this is a site that's trying to do, and a show that's trying to do something a little bit different. We're not just trying to look at some video and do, you know, prospect lists and, you know, base all our information, just copy and paste to aggregate clicks just to have one because everybody has a prospect list. Our good buddy contributed to the show, David Mills, listener to the show that has helped me over the last couple of years do some work, particularly on the development side. He's been in player development, but running his own trading facility, has had the ability to understand and interact with those around the game that understand the game on a more granular level, quite honestly, inside baseball type level. So we put together the prospect list, and I said to myself, what a perfect weekend with Pete Carl Armstrong coming to town. Not that it's at peak level Jared Kelnick trolling and hysteria. Nothing will ever repeat that. But there was some burgeoning discontent from the Met fan base, and not so much with the national media, but if he had an okay weekend, but if he had a big weekend and really terrorized the Mets and the Cubs would either sweep or win the series, geez, it would have been a big deal. But Pete Carl Armstrong was the topic of conversation in a lot of ways, the one the Mets let get away. And with the way that we here at the Talking Mets podcast do our prospect list, we do it top 15 positional, top 15 pitchers, parse them out so that you get the most content and the most feel of how an organization really is. Because, again, an organization has to look at their, you know, both sides of the ball. They can't just say, oh, these are our top 10 prospects. You know, of course, when you're doing some sort of maybe, you know, evaluation on a trade or what you could give up, maybe that comes into play. But truly, you want to look at your organization in two different ways. So why not release, you know, into the two-part discussion, we're going to talk about our top prospects list, David and I. On the positional side, we also talked about, and you'll hear that later in the week, on the pitching side. So we started with the positional side today because, obviously, with Pete Carl Armstrong being in town, and then we went over to the pitching side, and the plan is this. The Mets have a day off on Thursday in between the Pirates series and then, obviously, the Subway Series Part 1 2025. So I'll play the pitching side on Thursday. So you'll get that on Thursday. So some midweek content. Hopefully nothing crazy happens that, you know, the Mets world falls down on their head and then we have to, you know, cancel it. But the plan is to get that out. I don't see why not. Under David Stearns, I don't have to have all these like hold my breath moments where I can't plan out my schedule because, you know, what if somebody gets fired? What if something crazy happens and the Mets have to have an emergency press conference to talk about a fight in the dugout or whatever it may be? So it's a nice feeling to have some kind of functionality. But the real thing is, so, you know, who wouldn't want what Pete Carl Armstrong brings to the table in terms of speed, defense, base running, obviously power at a premium position in center field? And he would fit in perfectly with this Mets team because clearly Tyrone Taylor is a nice center fielder, but he's a backup. And Jeff McNeil, I give him credit for wanting to play center field. He's a versatile guy, but he's not a center fielder. And Jose Siri, before he went down with the tibia injury, he was more of a base runner and defensive and really profiles more of a fourth outfielder. You thought you were getting a version of Harrison Bader, maybe a little bit better. His bat is pretty bad, what we saw. We'll see what happens as the year goes on. And if you look up and down the organization, right now, you know, Acuña, who you heard in the intro and who is going to be talked about, because he's still technically a prospect during the segment that's coming up, you know, can play a little center field. You have Drew Gilbert. But, you know, by and large, there is nobody like Pete Carl Armstrong in the organization. And, you know, I guess a lot of Mets fans are smarting from the fact that, hey, this guy was in the Mets organization. And, you know, how did they let him get away? And I know Zach Scott has gone on record and talked a little about it. You heard essentially a synopsis of what he talked about, you know, why he traded Carl Armstrong, basically going back to his knowledge of the player from his Boston days and how they viewed him in the draft. And I could totally understand them viewing him in a sense as potential fourth outfielder. So let's keep a couple of things in mind with Pete Carl Armstrong when the deal was made, because it's very easy to look back and say bad deal. And yes, in a vacuum, you give up a player for a rental. You never really want to give up somebody that comes back and haunts you for a rental because you just don't know, especially a rental you're only getting 8 weeks on. Now, it's one thing to give up, and at one point, if you remember, Francisco Lindor, before he signed the contract extension before opening day, he was being acquired as a rental. And this is early in the Steve Cohen era, so you didn't know what you had. You knew Steve Cohen had a lot of money, but Mets were not a team that was a sure bet to keep their rentals. I mean, yeah, they kept Piazza, back in the day, but they were no sure bet, and they did keep Cespedes, but it a lot had to happen for Cespedes to fall back to them, and it cost them also Daniel Murphy when they did that. So financially, you never knew if the Mets were going to keep any of their free agents, and Baez was a guy, in his smack middle of his prime. But from a standpoint of the kind of player that was sustainable, you knew that there was a possibility that, maybe things would get a little off course with him because of his free swinging ways and what have you. Now, here's a guy, though, that came to the Mets and in about 50 ball games had a 140 OPS plus, hit almost 300, hit 9 home runs, was an energizing spark on the base paths. Provided a dynamicism with his bat that, there was actually, myself included, talk, should they combine Baez and Lindor, who are buddies, great fielders up the middle, this great up the middle tandem, and make them kind of like the cornerstone of the new Mets. And Baez was looking for a lot of money. The Mets weren't willing to go there. He wound up going to Detroit, and the Mets faded down the stretch, and a big part of that was Jacob deGrom's injury. So here's the real thing. Remember something about Pete Carl Armstrong, and this is really, really important. And I think it really ties into when we get into the prospect talk later on in part, second half of this show. Pete Carl Armstrong, ironically, when he was drafted, a lot of people, like the Mets, are drafting to kind of wipe away the stench of Kelnick because they drafted him in the first round in 2020. That was that COVID draft where you only, I think, had 6 rounds. They drafted him. So first problem is, here you are, you're drafting people during COVID. So you have all sorts of wacky shutdowns and a lack of scouting. There's all sorts of chaos going on in the world. So problem number one. Number two, then in 2021, he had some sort of injury. I don't know what it was. But at 19 years old, he played in only 6 games in St. Lucie. Now, he hit well in 6 games, but it was such a small sample size, you had no ability to evaluate him. So now let's also remember who the top Mets prospects were in 2025. It was not a system. It was starting to get better. The Mets were starting to make inroads, but I'm going to read off some of the top prospects from preseason 2021. Ronnie Mauricio, you're familiar with him. Matthew Allen, just now, 4 years later, making a comeback and starting to throw again in the minor leagues. Francisco Alvarez, I think you've heard of him. Brett Beatty, Pete Crow Armstrong, Mark Vientos, and then round out the top 10 is Josh Wolf, Jalen Palmer, JT Ginn, who pitched pretty well against the Mets for the A's about a month ago, and Franklin Quilome. And then Thomas Zapucki is right on the outside. He wound up getting traded for Darren Ruff. So if you look, Josh Wolf wound up getting traded in a Lindor deal. And nobody's heard about Jalen Palmer. JT Ginn was part of the Bassett trade. Matthew Allen's been hurt. Alvarez, Beatty, and potentially Vientos have been big parts of the Mets in some way, shape, or form the last couple of years, and it looks like they're going to be a big part of the 2025 Mets. Beatty's starting to come around. Beatty's last stand, I call it. I know he didn't play against the lefty, but Beatty, Beatty could just take a page out of Mark Vientos. We talked about this. Beatty take a page out of Mark Vientos' book from last year, and all of a sudden things change in baseball really quick, and then we'll see if Mauricio can make his way back to the show. So when you look at that list, if you were going to get Baez, Javier Baez, and remember the situation at the time, Mets, I believe, were in first place. I don't know by how much. They had been injured. They weren't playing. They should have put the division away months earlier. The Braves were under 500. They were starting to make a run. And you had Jacob deGrom, who was having an all-time season. And I had said at the time, when you have a pitcher like deGrom, and Stroman wasn't pitching that bad, and you had Diaz as a closer, there was enough on that team to say if they got into the tournament, that was the feeling. If you got into the tournament, the Mets could make a run with DeGrom because of how good he was. And after all the garbage and the nonsense and the BS and how they did not leverage or build upon the pennant of 2015 with the aces and all that, and Wheeler was gone and Harvey was gone, all you really had left, Mats was gone. All you had left was DeGrom. You wanted to get something. And the Cohen's first year ownership, how special would it be to make a deep postseason run? So there was a lot of pressure to do something. If the Mets had not done anything at the deadline and wound up winning, where they finished with 77 wins, I think they would be viewed way differently. You couldn't win in that situation. It was a tough spot. And the Cubs had the Mets by you know what. Now, could they have done a better job of holding out and not giving up as much value, especially because you were still in that period of time where if you didn't pay money, it was one of those choices. If you didn't pay money, you couldn't get a top prospect. And if you wanted the other team to eat salary, you could get the top prospect. Now, it's swung back a little way. There was a period where you could, for rental, didn't matter who they were. They weren't, nobody was giving you a top prospects. And then money came into the play, and then it was almost prospects. Look at how the Mets got Acuna and Drew Gilbert. Prospects and money became part of the deal. I'll pay part of that salary, or a big part of that salary, and you know, you'll give me something back for doing such a thing. You know, part of that is I'm basically paying for a prospect at that point. So I don't want to get into how the negotiations went down. You heard Zach Scott talk about his mistake. But if you look at all those top names, Mauricio, Allen, Alvarez, Beatty, Armstrong, Vientos, Armstrong was the easiest one to deal. There was no resume. It was all projection at that point in August of 2021. And I could honestly, and he just started playing well, but early in his career, very short career, you could see where maybe the bat could have also easily been a fourth outfielder bat. Now, he's got a, you know, coming into today's game, and he hit a home run. He hit his 10th home run coming into today's game. You know, he's got an OPS over 800. You know, there's everything about the guy to like. You know, he's going to rank really well on advanced analytics because of his defense, because of his base running. So he's always going to have a good wins above replacement. But he is a free swinger. He strikes out a lot. And I think from a bat perspective, I don't think he's going to be, let's put it this way, you didn't trade Mickey Mantle. And what's funny is that, I mean, the Mets got so mauled from the public. I mean, Jared Kelnick is in the minor leagues. Jared Kelnick, I really believe his career went south because he was traded by the Mets, because they used him, the media, during a time when they wanted to weaponize everything Mets related. They used him as a weapon and put such unreal expectations on the kid. That now he's in Gwinnett in AAA, and he's hitting okay, but he's not, you know, he's 25 years old now, and he's very likely headed for a career as a 4A player. Maybe eventually if he finds a home, it's never going to be as an established star. So you look at that, and, you know, Crow Armstrong's coming off of that, and the Mets, you know, make this deal, but nobody ever knows that Fernando Tatis Jr., was traded by the White Sox in the James Shields deal, when James Shields was traded to the White Sox when they were trying to win and make a run for James Shields. Nobody knows that Yordan Alvarez. Do you know Yordan Alvarez? One of the best hitters in the history of the sport. He's right up there when we were doing our Soto Judge analysis. Do you know that he was traded from the Dodgers in 2016? For Josh Fields. Now, Josh Fields was traded that year and wound up having, you know, some success with the Dodgers. Like the Dodgers do, they brought him in and they turned him into a really good reliever for a couple of years. So he was useful, but they gave an elite top bat away for him. Nobody talks about that. So this happens. And when you're a contender, and I have a feeling that this is a situation that David Stearns might face this year, because as good as the Mets are, you're looking at their roster, maybe they need another bat. There's already talk about Luis Roberts Jr. and center field being maybe an area to upgrade. Love the pitching. The pitching showed that it belongs with how both Clay Holmes and Griffin Canning shut down the Cubs this weekend. It shows that their repertoire and their approach is sustainable, because they're not doing against second division clubs. This is a team averaging 5.8 runs per game. They barely got over 3 runs per game. Two of the three games, and as a matter of fact, today they got 3 hits. Two of the three games, they scored less than 3 runs. The other game, they scored what their average was, which was 6. That's all on Saturday night. And it was a couple of bad pitches that made it happen. You know, a couple of bad pitches that made it happen. So, you're seeing it sustainable. So the Mets are going to be in a position where, honestly, there's going to be some of these prospects that we're talking about in a couple of minutes that David and I are going to be talking about that are going to potentially be traded. And they're going to be traded for a player that's useful now, who 4 years from now may be out of the sport, or, you know, not as good, or who knows. but not in a vacuum, the value may not be equal. Nobody would say Tatis Jr. for James Shields is a fair trade. Nobody would say Josh Fields for Yordan Alvarez is a fair trade. When they were made, was it as big of a deal back then? I don't remember anybody throwing a tantrum. I know they threw tantrums over the Kelenic deal, and I know that Crow Armstrong, I don't remember too many people criticizing it when it happened when Baez was brought over because of the dynamicism of Lindor and Baez up the middle and how, for the time that he was here, how good of a hitter he was. It was a small sample size, and it was a little bit of a different hitter than what he was advertised. But a guy like that in an energy environment, he's an energy player, did well for the 8 weeks that he was in town. And I know that then he got involved in the thumbs down. And there was still some of that residual media negativity that the Mets were battling that have since thrown away as the yoke has been broken since OMG 2024. So it was a different environment. I believe it's an understandable trade. I think it was a tough call. If the Mets had done nothing, they would have been criticized. If the Mets had done something like they did and it doesn't work out in 2, 3, 4 years, they get criticized. Here's the key, and this is what the hope is now, where the Mets are in a better position, that they have their senior vice president of player development, Andy Green, former big leaguer, former manager, and he's been around a couple of years. The Mets have had 5 head of player development in that role since 2017, since Sandy Alderson was around his first term as general manager. I mean, this in and out, because of Brody and because of Jared Porter and Zach Scott and all the things that went into the transition from one ownership group to another. That has led to probably the farm system not being exactly as well oiled as you'd want it to be year, 5 into Cohen's ownership. It took some time for him to learn the, you know, to take the keys and learn what he's got here in this car that he's driving. And now it's Stearns in charge. And remember, Stearns is year 2 now. Stearns is only here a couple of years, and he's doing what every other general manager, president, whatever you want to, you know, reference from the time that, you know, Sandy Alderson came back and guided Cohen, they're asked to compete and win now while developing a foundation and build an organization for the future. Almost an unheard of, impossible task. It usually, when you want to build a sustainable infrastructure, like Houston did, like Chicago did, like Baltimore, I know they're having a tough year, like Baltimore has, or thought they were doing, it takes a complete tear down, usually, and a 3 to 5 year rebuild, and some ugly, ugly times. And Cohen hasn't done that. He knows that that would be extremely risky and difficult in this town. So, good weekend for the Mets. Probably talk more about the big league club as we head into the Subway Series. Taking care of business. The pitching continues, and I think it was a big test this week in the pitching, and they passed it with flying colors. I know McGill wasn't great, but McGill, I think, is having some regression to the mean. He wasn't a guy that was going to pitch to a 105 ERA all year. The offense is starting to come around. I know they're still leaving a ton of runners on base. I know that Soto was disappointing on Saturday night. But, you know, while Soto figures this thing out, Lindor looks every bit comfortable being a Met. I mean, this is home for him now. I mean, I've never seen him this locked in and comfortable, even last year, when many thought, myself included, that he should have been the MVP. And, you know, the Mets are doing their thing. Diaz seems to be rounding back into form. I'm a little bit worried about the bullpen. I'm a little bit worried about the length of the starters. They're starting to push the starters a little bit. That's going to be important. I know there will be some cavalry coming over the hill with Manaea Montas in the near future. And away you go. So let's take a quick break. When I come back, on that note, on the whole Pete Crow Armstrong note, on the weekend where Pete Crow Armstrong came back to New York, hit a home run, showed off his defensive prowess and his base running prowess, let's talk about the Mets' positional prospects, early season positional prospect ranking, talking Mets beyond the mic style. Our good friend contributor David Mills, who does great work doing all the research, putting the list together, talking to those that give him some really good inside baseball information. Let's hear from David. Let's hear what his thoughts are. And by the way, while you're listening, why don't you go over and sign up? There's free trials and whatnot at substack.com/@talkingmetsnog and take a look at the top 15 positional and top 15 pitching prospects. You won't regret it. Tons of good information. All right, let's take a quick break. We'll be back talking Mets positional prospects right after this.
And he lines one up the middle for a base hit, and that has a run in it. Torrens comes in to score. Luis Angel Acuna with the RBI single, and it's 2-0 New York.
All right, we're back, and joining me, good friend of the show, you guys, if you're subscribers to Talking Mets, Beyond the Mic, know him, David Mills. David's been part of baseball training for years, fan of the game, and one of the things he brings to the table that he does an awesome job, started last summer, is taking a look at the Mets' top prospects, both on the positional and pitching side of the organization, so doing it a little bit different. But not just looking at numbers or trying to look at publications that sometimes have an agenda in terms of how they publish the prospect rankings, but really getting into doing research about the process and why these individuals could be good for the big league club in the coming years. So joining me, David Mills. And David, welcome to the program. So an exciting time. The Mets are playing well. And here we have some prospects percolating, and we're going to start on the positional side. And as we were talking heading into the show, you had a lot of fun doing this because not just some of the guys that the fans know, the Acuñas, the Mauricios, and what have you. There's some interesting names that you popped up on this list.
Yeah, absolutely, Mike. And it's fun, but it's a lot of work. And you know, analyze the problem that you and I have, and others who do this sort of thing, is we never get to look at. I mean, I should not say never, but we look at highlights and we look at stats, and so we're not seeing the we're not seeing the three times somebody struck out. We're seeing the home run that he hit. You know, it's a lot easier for people who work in major league front offices to really analyze, see a lot of video. And that's the big difference.
Absolutely. And you, and I'll start with who your number one is, and we're starting to see him, and he's really not necessarily going to be a prospect much longer. He may have actually got himself a full-time job, and that's Luis Acuña. Now, Luis Acuña Jr., of course. Now, Acuña, to me, has tons of red flags. And he's surprised me. He's been one of the better surprises. I know that the pitching has been a huge surprise, but he's been a big surprise on the offensive side. He's a guy that I've always felt profiles as a backup 300 at bat around the field type of player. You know, obviously could run, play a little defense, but I wasn't sure he could hit because of his inability to walk, a little bit of a chase rate. And he has a very high batting average on balls in play, which should come down. I don't think he's a 300 hitter. But then I was looking at his numbers. He's starting to normalize at the big league level with his walk and strikeout rate. Even if his, what the analytics guys call luck, his BABIP comes down, a guy who hits 270 with speed and can play pretty good defense. I don't know if he's gold glove defense, but pretty good defense at three infield positions and possibly the outfield where we haven't seen him yet. Well, then you start, as you peel the onion, it starts to look like a pretty good player.
Well, I think when you watch him play, and last night was an example, he didn't hit particularly well last night. I think he was on base once and stole a base. But he made a play going to his left that was, oh, his range is phenomenal in the middle infield. Second base is just a great position for him. He also, if you watch him, he makes very accurate throws. He doesn't throw too many balls in the dirt. He's right there, man. He chests me. He chests Pete all the time. I mean, it's a pleasure to watch him play because he's so athletic, you know, much like his brother. But he's got probably more speed than his brother, although his brother used to be fast before all the knee injuries. And he has a line drive swing. And that's going to play. And I think he's, last year when he came up, you remember he hit some dingers. This year, he's not trying to uppercut the ball.
Yeah. That's not his game. Like, everybody got excited about that, and they were comparing him to his brother. I'm like, here he is, first week of the season. Half of those games were against garbage time Nats. And there's pitchers just, let's see what he's got. Let's throw a fastball. And he put wood on it. And once they get a book on him very quickly, they're not going to do that anymore to him.
Well, he's still, his problem is, and it it was very apparent last night, he chases down and away. So that makes him susceptible to the sliders and sweepers. Yep. And but you know what? He also went down and got one a couple of games ago and you know took it out to right field. So the reason he's on here is number one is because he came up last year in a very stressful situation with the Mets were literally playing for the postseason, and he performed beautifully at shortstop, no less. So I go number one. And Mauricio in there as number two also proved that he could play at big league baseball. It's hard to ignore those guys when you put together a prospect list. So they both come in under the, you know, under the, our guidelines.
And what's interesting is that they're possibly, and we'll see about Mauricio, both could have big parts potentially in a Mets run this year. Now, the thing about Mauricio is that we know there's that elite exit velocity. We saw a very small sample size of him back at the end of 2023. He's a guy that has been mixed reviews in the organization. Does he have a position? Is it middle infield? You know, is he going to be a guy that's just going to hit home runs, but, you know, not get on base and have a low batting average? But the more that you've seen of him before he hurt his leg, his Achilles, ACL, the more ACL. You get excited about him. And now there's some openings. Let's look at it this way. Marte has started to show that maybe the end is here. Winker's hurt. Beatty's playing himself back into the mix again. Beatty's last stand is really what we're looking at right now. A couple of home runs this weekend. And you now have Mauricio being called up. I think he did double A or triple A. So he's knocking on the door. What is Mauricio in your opinion? You like him. He's your number two prospect. Is this an everyday player that could be a component near All-Star? Is he a star? Where does he play? Is he like Acuna that could play around? I know the modern GM, Stearns is no exception, likes versatility. Where do you see him? What kind of player are we looking at here?
Oh, I think, first of all, if you've ever stood next to him, and I have, he is a big man. And he... A bit for a big man who's probably about 6'4", about 215, 220, maybe more. He has tremendous athletic ability, and he's very fast. He steals bases, or you know, he did before his injury, and he has a powerful arm and really soft hands. My guess, and I've mentioned it here. I think I mentioned it in last year's write-up. He could. Let's say they lost Pete. Pete signs elsewhere for next year. Well, I don't see any reason why he couldn't go to first base. With the only thing is you're not utilizing his gun, but a first baseman does have to throw from time to time. I wouldn't be surprised if you could put him out in center field. I think he tried a little outfield, wasn't particularly his thing, but with the right seasoning, he probably could play center field. And I might rather have him in center field than, say, Acuna or Jet Williams, but because he has power. So that's what everybody's looking for. They're looking for that power. And he's a switch hitter. So you know how I love left-handed hitters and switch hitters. And I think that in that versatile player that David Stearns and so many GMs like, he certainly could fit the bill. And like Acuna, right now, you know, as soon as he's in real baseball, he's actually playing at Binghamton right now. And he started out really well. He could slot into, you know, any of those infield roles that Acuna plays. So, and a little bit better than Beatty because both of those guys play shortstop. You know, and look, we're blessed with probably the best shortstop in the game. You know, with a nod to Witt. But I think that you know, that is a guy that every GM, every manager wants.
And it's so important to have these two guys. And I want to get to guys that are less overt, but I think this will be a theme as well on the pitching side. Everybody knows that Cohen's got all this money and the Cohen tax, which really is laughable that it's the Cohen tax. And who the hell knows what, with the CBA being up and everything that you read after 2026, I think there's going to be a push by a small group of Hawk owners to institute what you see in other sports, particularly the NBA, where if you're above a certain threshold, it's not just about the tax. They want to punish player movement. They want to punish the Dodgers and the Mets and the Yankees and the Phillies from being able to build out their roster if you're going to spend this kind of money on Juan Soto or Otani or any of these guys and you want to blow your payroll up, fine. But guess what? You're going to be limited to round out that roster. Knicks are going through, and again, salary cap sport. So we don't know what the sport's going to look like after 2026. So having controllable talent, I mean legit controllable talent, that you at least for 3 years can pay them whatever you want. We could argue that. Maybe that'll change a little bit in a new CBA. But have some cost control and get basically, in some cases, like you did with Alonso, all-star performance. This is gold because you can't fill out your roster with veterans everywhere. You can't. A good hitter is going to be $15 to $20 million a year off the bat. Off the bat. You know, everyone laughs. At this point going forward between Lindor and Soto, 30% of a $300 million payroll is going to be those two guys going forward. Two guys. No pitchers, no, nothing. So I think that, and I guess that leads into my next piece with this or my next comment on this. Who do you see outside of those two guys as the next possible impact player in the next year to 2 years? Because going into this CBA, I think the Mets have to have some crystallization. Who can be my positional players? Let's say they sign Alonso. That's another big contract. You got Soto, big contract. You got Alonso, big contract. Alvarez and Vientos will be coming up on some paydays out there. Lindor is in the lineup, big contract. Nimmo, big-ish contract. So who's the next one? Who can the fans be looking towards that as we get to this possible lockout strike and the changes that could be happening? Who can potentially be core, even if they're not, you know, Hall of Fame types or Pete Alonso Soto types, but really high-level contributors for the positional side of the ball?
Well, among positional players, I think we're, after Acuña's already there and Mauricio, who could be there, you know, in August of this year easily. I don't think there's anybody else who's really posturing to be with the Mets even next season.
Yeah, even Drew Gilbert. That would surprise some fans.
I think Drew Gilbert could be in play. But if they go out and, let's say they go out and make a deal for somebody like Luis Robert, then, you know, I don't know where that leaves Drew Gilbert, because you have both of the corner outfielders are left-handed hitters. And, you know, having a Robert in center field as a right-handed hitter is, you know, probably balance. But that's the problem. And one of the things that happens when you sign guys to long-term deals, like you sign Nimmo or Soto, Lindor, and I happen to think they'll sign Pete to some 4-year.
He doesn't want to leave unless something like red flags between now. He doesn't want to leave. And I look, I don't know how much market he'll still have. I mean, he's at an age where history says he's going to decline. I got a number of players I mentioned, Richie Sexton, Paul Konerko. I mean, on and on, even Albert Pujols, Hall of Famer. So, you know, go back to the 60s, happened again to big right-handed hitters.
Right. Well, I allude to that. And what happens is you jam up the roster with all these guys and you have no place to put the prospects. Sure. Now, so it's actually maybe a blessing that the Mets aren't loaded with guys who are ready to play next year. I think even in the pitching, which we'll get to later, you have two or three guys who you have a couple of guys who could be up this year, and maybe another one or two next year included. So 3-4 tops, but most of them are out there in 2028. So, and that's a good thing, because in the pitching case, you have all of these pitchers who are signed for the next 2 years after this one. But so I wouldn't look on the Mets prospect horizon for a lot of help this year or even next.
Who excites you the most? I mean, when I've had Ernie Dove on, our good friend that is down in St. Lucie, does some prospect stuff on social media. Jesus Baez was a guy that was talking about last year. He's number 5 on our list. By the way, if you go to Talking Mets Beyond Mike, substack.com/@TalkingMetsNoG, you can subscribe. These are actually free for everybody to get a little feel of the product and what we offer. Who has some of the most upside to you out of your top 10? I know you go 15 on the positional, but I'm assuming, unless there's somebody that you look outside of the 10 that you say, hey, that's the guy in the next you know, 2 to 3 years that's really going to be making a name for himself, maybe going to be in the, somebody who's going to be in the top 100 of MILB pipeline or something like that.
Right. Well, I think that we do a top 15 positional players and a top 10 pitchers. So we're a little bit different than everybody else. But I always think blending them together really makes it, you know, deciding who's the number one prospect.
Very hard. Different. Yeah.
Goofy, in my opinion. But there's a couple of guys that stand out. So there's somebody I've had my eye on for the past few seasons, and he was on my list. I think he was number 5 or 6 in the fall, and he's number 10 this year, only because he was injured most of the second half of last year, is Jacob Reimer. And boy, this guy can hit, man. He's a raker. I mean, he goes out there, he crushes the ball. He's a corner guy, third base, first base, play a little left field, maybe right field. But boy, he has a bat that's hard to suppress. So there's one. Boston Barrow is another one. I had said, I think one of the times we talked before the breakout game, I said, watch Boston Barrow. And he hit a home run in the game. He's an infielder. He plays mostly shortstop, but he could play second base. He's probably destined more for third base. Another guy you could probably throw out in the outfield, because it seems like every shortstop you could put in center field. I'm really high on Boston Barrow. He's in Brooklyn right now. So is Reimer. And then I would say there's a guy named A.J. Ewing, who's really broken out, and he's a speedster, another guy who plays middle infield, but probably could play third base, and does play some outfield. He's just steals bases almost at will, and he has an excellent bat. So there's three guys, but they're all three of those guys are 2008 at the earliest. 2028 at the earliest. So, you know, other guys, yeah, I like Baez. Okay, the other guy is Carson Benge, who I wasn't really, I didn't put him on my list last year because they had just drafted him. He hadn't swung a bat in a minor league game. But he's the kind of guy, if the Mets don't go out and get a center fielder, you could see a Carson Benge maybe in 2027. Competing with a Drew Gilbert and a couple of others. But the problem for him and for Gilbert is they're left-handed hitters. Do the Mets want to throw nothing but left-handed hitters out in the outfield, as much as I like left-handed hitters?
Yep, that's interesting, especially they're not switch hitters and what have you. So
now there's another guy in that mix, by the way, Eli Serrano III. The third. And this guy came out of North Carolina. He's about 6'6", tons of power. But again, another left-handed hitting outfielder. His exit velocities are like mind-numbing. His exit velocities are 106 to 109 and on a regular basis. And he's a pretty good athlete. He's got speed. He's got a good arm. He could play center field or the corners. So there's another, like, kind of a sleeper guy. The rest are kind of middle infielders, like a Marco Vargas. Boy, he was brought up from St. Lucie to Brooklyn recently, and then from Brooklyn to Binghamton, and he hits at all levels. Smart ball player, good base runner, excellent second baseman. I mean, he's got all the tools, but the Mets are really clogged up everywhere.
And that's good, because they're going for it the next couple of years. I don't think they're going to burn the farm down, but they're going for it. They may need a starting pitcher. They may need a center fielder. Who knows, you know, what's going to happen on this club and who becomes available. It's interesting. These are so important, these prospects, because as much as the Mets are a finished, established, contending team, there's still a lot of questions over the next 12 months. It's not like you could say, hey, like the 80s Mets, you knew who their rotation was going to be for 5 years. You know who their positional players, their core positional players are going to be for 5 years. Things are going to change. You're still trying to figure out Beatty. You're still trying to figure out if Mauricio has a role here. Acuna, is he for real? Even Vientos, to a certain degree, I know he's established, but what do you have there? Is he a DH? Is he somebody that can be a borderline all-star? Or is he somebody that is a seven hitter in a lineup? So it's actually, over the next few years, things working out. And the timeline, I brought up the whole CBA. You brought up Brooklyn. Not only is that perfectly aligned for how the world could change in MLB in 36 months. Maybe 48, but depending what you look, probably 24 to 36 months. That's a local minor league team. They're no longer short season. I know that in talking to some people that used it as a entertainment venue, that bothers them a little bit because they liked it from June to September. It was kind of like a summer thing to do. But from a baseball perspective, you're going out there, and you and I have talked about this offline. You have a lot of interesting names because the Mets, if you remember, when the Wilpons owned it from day one, that was a money-making marketing venture as much as it was development. They would leave older non-prospects down there because they'd want to win the New York Penn League. They wanted to have a championship there. It was almost channeling the old Dodgers, you know, Fred Wilpon being from Brooklyn. It was a big topic of conversation back in the day. Mets don't do that anymore. Now they're and they were almost, I think, considering it to be a double A team before they worked out stuff with the Binghamton municipality. So a lot of exciting things happening in Brooklyn. It's a nice environment from June to September. It might be a little cold in April, might be a little cold after Labor Day sometimes, but it's a nice environment. And now you get to see some real legit, the way that the Mets are running it now, legitimate prospects here, just if you're in the city in your backyard.
Well, if you're a baseball fan and you live in the five boroughs, you live on Long Island, you got to get out to Brooklyn. First of all, it's a really enjoyable ballpark to be in. It's right there at Coney Island. Lots of stuff going on all around you. Lots of cheap eats. But you have a roster there that's just chock full of legitimate, honest to goodness prospects. It'll blow your mind. I mean, you got Reimer, you got Baez, you got Bedge, you got Morabito, I think, was moved up to Binghamton. You've got A.J. Ewing, you've got Serrano. I mean, it is just amazing what you've got there, and you've got some really top-notch pitching as well. So, to look at that roster and also understand that these guys are 2 or 3 years away kind of fits into that Mets plan and also, you know, you got to remember, when you chock full your roster with prospects, a lot of them are going to be trade pieces. So you need that. Let's say you need that lefty closer in 2 years who's out there, somebody fantastic. And you're saying, well, we've got the prospects to at least get somebody interested in talking to us. There are some teams where I have nobody anybody's interested in talking about. So that's a real. It's kind of a smoke signal to every team that, hey, we've got guys. If you've got somebody you want to get rid of, you can't pay. You know, you maybe isn't fitting in with your major league roster or your team. Well, we've got some things that can help you. So I think in that respect, the Mets and if that was Stern's plan, I'm not sure if it was a plan because he's only been doing this for. What is it, a year?
It's so new. I mean, people don't understand.
He fell into place. He probably got lucky in a way because most of these guys were already there. And so he inherited a farm system that was on the upswing. And I'm sure he's grateful for that. But there is something to be said for loading up the system. And I think for most fans who aren't as keen observers as, you know, some of us who do these crazy things and analyze the team from top to bottom, there's a lot of reasons why you want good prospects.
And, you know, this is an interesting weekend to talk about positional prospects because Pete Crow Armstrong is across the field at Citi Field this weekend. And everybody's freaking out. And I talked about it in a segment on the show about, I'm not going to get into the Baez trade in this segment. That's not for now. But it's always hard to keep everybody. And I think the thing that I find that will be easier for the Mets, possibly, when you make your decisions, when you have that Javier Baez trade, and there's a Crow Armstrong sitting there who was 7 at-bats into his pro career when he was traded, something like that, you have to have strong information and you have to have everybody in your leadership team, your front office, all on the same page with whatever kind of player that you're looking to procure and develop. Andy Green's been in the job as head of player development now. This is his second year. Mets have had so many heads of player development since Brody Van Wagenen was here, or even before the end of Sandy Alderson's term, his first term here in front office. You can't have that turnover and have a consistent type of player or a player development strategy. And that's hurt the Mets. So even with Cohen's money and all the development and all the things that have gone well, now they have people in place that hopefully will – now they'll get plucked because other organizations might offer them promotions. But you look at that team he put together. The reason Stearns hasn't really hired a GM is because he's got a bunch of GMs under him doing specific tasks. And I think that that's really important. And I think that that will make it easier for the Mets this trade deadline and going forward to say, okay, these are the kind of players we like. These are the kind of players that we – or skill sets we think – are going to make it long term. We could trade this guy, we could keep this guy, and feel confident that you made the best decision possible. Now, I'm not as high on, I mean, I think Carl Armstrong's a good player, but I don't think he's going to be what everybody thinks here, because he got hot here for 6 weeks at the beginning of the season with some power. But anyway, you don't want to give up a premium gold glove elite center fielder with power for a rental if you could avoid it. And I think that's kind of one of the areas I was thinking about as I was going through this list.
Well, I think what happened there, and by the way, I disagree. I do think that PCA is going to be, if he's not going to be a superstar, he's going to be right there on the cusp. But he just does too many things too well to not, especially his defense and his base running. So if he puts the hit component to that, which he seems to have a lot more power than the Mets expected, I think that's a terrific ball player. But what I think happened there, I think Lindor put some pressure on, and, you know, the Mets wanted to do something nice for Lindor, and Baez, you know, they were high school teammates. In fact, some friends of mine who were scouts said they had never seen a double play combination like that in high school. And, you know, Baez had his strengths, but I never liked his bat because he would strike out. He still does. I mean, look what he's kind of deteriorated into while Lindor is on the rise. Baez is certainly on the downswing. But, yeah, you got to be careful of those deals. At the time, I think the Mets were a little desperate. You got to be careful. Remember, they wanted to stay in the race. And what was it, 21 when they made that deal?
Yeah, 2021, and they got him for Baez. And
yeah, and basically, it didn't make a whole lot of sense. So you have to be careful. But, you know, that's going to happen. You're going to get your clock.
And it could happen here. I mean, there's a lot of logjam, and it could. And I think that's the thing. Not every one of these players that you and I are talking about will ever see a Mets uniform. They might go down in history as you know, the big trade. They may go down as Hubie Brooks, who had a good Mets career but got traded for Gary Carter. You know, others, you know, Calvin Schiraldi, who was actually, people don't realize, I know he gets known for a mediocre big league career and what happened in the 86 World Series, but he was a big time pitching prospect. I'm going way back now on that whole thing. So a big time pitching prospect and what have you. Now, as we round out the positional prospect before we get to pitching. Couple of things here. I have, and I was looking at your list and I'm thinking, who's the one guy that I think is going to turn out to be the biggest disappointment? I hate to go negative, but I'm going to start there. And then I have another, the positive side to it. I have Ryan Clifford. Ryan Clifford, to me, I know the power. I know the fans love the power. I see home runs littering my Twitter feed. Anytime the guy hits a home run, I mean, the guy could hit the ball out of Brooklyn. Going back to Brooklyn, not an easy place to hit the ball out. Water right off the water, you know, heavy, you know, balls in that park. Ball doesn't carry. I don't know how it is, but back in the day, it wasn't. Now I know weather patterns have changed here in New York. But Ryan Clifford is one I have as possibly, and I don't want to be negative on the guy. I hate to use the word bust, but maybe a bust or maybe overrated or maybe the one that I'm just not convinced he's going to make it. Do you agree? And do you have somebody different that you're kind of a little dubious about?
No, if you said to me, you have 15 positional prospects here, and some. I have five catchers as the honorable mentions, which was kind of interesting, actually. But if you said, hey, Dave, if you had to eliminate one guy as not maybe making it to any MLB roster, I would agree. Clifford, to me, has tremendous power. At the same time, he and Mauricio are the two guys with the most power here. But which one of those guys would I rather keep if I'm looking for a power hitter? I'd rather keep Mauricio because he has so many other skills. Now, Clifford is not a defender. It's really hard to put him in a position. He plays corner outfield at first base. He's a really terrible outfielder. So at first base, he's not that good either, but you'd have to really work with him. And that's possible, but I agree with you. And I don't want to waste too much time on it. He's on my list at 8, but the power could still, he's still young. So what is he, 21? So, he's 21. And I would say that it's possible, let's say this year or next, he could just start hitting home runs at will. And if that's the case, well, you got to look more seriously at it. But there's just as much cases he'll keep striking out a lot and not be a defender who's even worth putting on a major league diamond.
Are you surprised how far Kevin Parada has fallen?
That surprised. No.
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 You didn't like the pick at the beginning.
I thought it was a poor pick. I have a friend who was a star at Georgia Tech. I have a friend who was on the team that had, I think, 7 guys go to the major leagues. Jay Payton was one of them. And the shortstop for the Red Sox who went to the Dodgers. Why is the name escaping me right now? But there were a lot of great players. So we watched Georgia Tech a little bit. I'm not surprised at all. And I think it's kind of sad in a way. It's funny. He improved his receiving, which was his big short spot. He was known as a hitter. They thought he was going to be a hitter, and his hitting has gone down the drain. His catching has improved. Yeah. So,
yep. You got that. You also do honorable mention, like guys that just didn't make it, but you're intrigued by.
Yes.
Give me a name. You know, we want everybody to kind of go and marinate on this and dive into this on the Substack. But what is the name that you really are like honorable mention, but you have a good, your gut's telling you you're going to be writing about him in the top 15 at the either end of the year when you do the fall version or next year?
So when you get down to the bottom of the list, you have some, you know, choices to make. And yeah, it's fun to do. I chose to have Ilian Pena he came out of the DR and the Mets gave him about $5 million to sign. And I was thinking, Ilian still hadn't played in a minor league game. He had only played developmental ball in the league in DR. So I said, no, let me put him 50 because he is incredibly talented. I watched a lot of video. Boy, this guy, he has power. He can hit tall fields. He's excellent soft hands, good throwing from different angles. So I made him 15. And hopefully we'll get to see him play at St. Lucie very soon. But they had all these catchers who kind of, you know, grabbed my attention. And the one who would fit your question, I think, is a guy named Christopher Suero, who's from the Bronx. He's a decent receiver, but he also plays all the corners. He could play first, third, left, right. And I think the future of catching and roster construction is to have somebody on that roster who's a hitter, who could DH, and who could play some positions, but who can also catch. The Mets got into a situation like that a couple times this year where they had Senger and Torrens, where you didn't know who was going to be the backup catcher because you had one of them out.
And now they have three. I mean, look, they have two really good catchers at the big league roster. And Senger is more of he's probably a backup in the big leagues who can't hit. I think Torrens obviously is a better hitter. And he has a better arm, but Senger's not that far off defensively. Maybe better from a blocking the balls in the dirt. Some of his
Senger, of his skills. I think
Torrens and Alvarez are good with the arm and framing to it, but they're not good at blocking pitches in the dirt. I can tell you that. You
know? No, the best all around catcher. I had a catching academy, so that's something that I always keep my eye on. Senger, he may be he's certainly the best pure catcher in the Mets organization and probably one of the top 5 in all of baseball. So having him at Syracuse ready to come up at moment's notice is a very important thing. But the future of roster construction is to have somebody who could be a third string, who could play other positions in that emergency or at that time you want to put a pinch hitter up. And maybe he's a good pinch hitter, but you get a pinch hitter pinch hit him for the catcher. So Christopher Suero, somebody to watch. The Mets have two young catchers who are very interesting, but still it's really hard. That's Ivani Rodriguez and Diverson Gutierrez. Very interesting to watch. They're like 19 and 20. But the guy who's playing at Binghamton right now, who caught last night the perfect, almost a complete perfect game by Jonah Tong, is Ronald Hernandez, who they got in the deal for Robertson.
Just like Vargas. So you talked about Vargas. So here you got a relief pitcher that pitched very badly for the Marlins. Two interesting pieces for him.
And Hernandez is a switch hitter, and he's bilingual, which is something everybody talks about. Kind of guy who could, he's becoming a better catcher, and that's what they're hoping over this year and next. So he could be a guy that they keep around, because how many switch hitting catchers are there anywhere in baseball? There's no Butch Weinigers anymore.
Yeah. So that now you're dating yourself, Butch Weiniger. There you go.
Wasn't the Yankees catcher, wasn't he a switcher?
Yeah, he's actually in the early days of my WGBB show. I had him on as an alumni guest. He had some really interesting stories. So
I think that you have, and then I put Parada at the very bottom of that list, but look how far, the powerful have fallen, because he's fallen to the last honorable mention from being a first round draft choice, just three seasons ago. Catching is something that the Mets have some depth in the minor leagues, and again provides you with trade fodder. So anybody looking for a catcher who could replace somebody that's getting older, like Kansas City, right? So Salvador, he's getting old. He's basically now, but somebody like that might want a good catcher for the farm system to grow on. So. Mm-hmm. That's the honorable mention thing. And I just thought it was kind of interesting that I was able to gang up the five catching prospects.
Yeah, premium positions, absolutely. One other quick thing, is there a type of players you're seeing that Stearns, a front office target when they look at positional players in the draft? Is there any kind of trend that you're seeing with them in the short time that they've been running the show?
I'd say... Again, it's hard because it's such a short time he's running the show, but I would say that the thing that I would say he's more into that from the pitching perspective. And I think that from the positional perspective, is you just try to draft. Everybody's doing it. They draft so many shortstops, and then they figure any shortstop they could put anywhere on the field. But I always have my eye on the guys who have blazing speed and who are real base runner, base stealers. And there are two guys who fit that mold beautifully here are Morabito and A.J. Ewing. And those are two guys worth watching, because, anybody who runs well, steals 40, 50 bases is an exciting player in my book.
But yeah, even with the new rules, it's an art that came into vogue late 70s, 80s, went away in the 90s, and has never come back. Well, Dave... Let's stick around. Part two coming up. Mets top 15 positional prospects. Honorable mention, Dave has run Baseball Academy. You heard him talk about being a catching instructor. We're trying to do things a little differently. And it's actually Dave's creation, not mine. He's the genesis and one of the best contributions he does among many, other than being a motivational coach behind the scenes, telling me as a listener what works and what doesn't with the show. Is his ability, because this is something over the years I've always struggled with, is the minor league system, and fans love it. And what better weekend to release the positional prospect dialogue, and prior to this, the Substack newsletter print version, than when Pete Crow Armstrong is in town at Citi Field driving Mets fans nuts. So anyway, all right, we'll be back with part two later this week. You're listening to the Talking Mets podcast. We're back with more, and we'll wrap up right after this. And that was the top 15 Talking Mets podcast positional prospects. Hope you enjoyed the segment. A couple of quick things on that. Again, I think it's critically important over the next 2-3 years for the Mets to amp up their farm system. I think that some really gnarly rules against spending are going to come down, regardless of how long. And I think there will be either strike or a lockout. I think we're going to miss some baseball in 2027. I'm fearful. I'm fearful of what's going to happen to the sport in 2027, but that's a story for another day. And whatever comes out of it, I think it's going to get harder and harder to sustain, even if, even from a financial standpoint, sustain, maintain, and buy every single need to win a championship if you're a contending team. Even if you're the Mets and the Dodgers, who have the financial wherewithal and are willing to lose money. Let's face it. If that's a thing you believe in, you know, depending on how the accounting really works, you're going to have to develop different parts of your roster. I think the pitching is going to be critically important. We'll talk about that in part two, to develop, because how expensive and how injury prone it is. Every offensive player, not every player is going to get a 15-year contract like Juan Soto, but you know, even a Willy Adames, these guys are getting, these really good power hitting, near all-star type players are getting, you know, $25 million a year for seven, you know, $30 million a year for maybe 6-7 years. Offense and quality offense is getting expensive. And that's why those first 3 to 6 years, if you could develop, especially if you could develop component parts of your club. I mean, look at what Acuña is doing for them this year, adding as a component player some really nice base running, defense, a little bit of hitting. A veteran that gives those things like Acuña does, they're going to cost, even as a backup sometimes, they're going to cost, you know, $4-5 million a year. Is it as a component player? So it's not, they're not cheap. I mean, you know, $2-4 million a year. It all adds up. So you have to have some cost control talent, but you also have to have some high upside players like the what you saw at Citi Field this weekend with Pete Carl Armstrong and what Pete Alonso and Jeff McNeil used to be and what Vientos is. And what Lindor at one point used to be in Cleveland before he got paid coming to New York, and what Soto was in D.C. before he got paid, and what have you. So I think that it's really appropriate on a weekend where we saw a former Mets prospect come in and really wonder, oh, not so much what if, because the Mets are in a bad spot. Oh, man, we could really use that guy. I mean, they could use him. But also remember, you have no idea what could have transpired in other deals if he was still in the organization. So time to move on that. I think the real good news out of all of this is the Mets have a stable front office. They have a philosophy. They have people in place now that have been in place for at least a couple of years. You should start to see a philosophy. You should start to see that bear fruit, because you're not changing things over. Everybody, look, Zach Scott intelligently talked about why he traded PCA. And at some point this year, I really feel either the pitching side more likely, but even on the offensive side, you know, is it possible that Drew Gilbert becomes a player that another team desires and the Mets have to pull the trigger to bring in a starting pitcher or a bullpen arm or a component offensive player, maybe a center fielder? Possibly. Does he go on to have a really good career and that player only helps the Mets for a short time? Possibly. If the Mets win a championship, are you going to be upset? Maybe, maybe not. Probably not. That's the risk you take. But you have to know what you have. You have to have tight evaluation. And you have to have people in place that have been through the organization and are all rowing in the same direction with the same philosophy for a while. And the Mets didn't have that for a long time. Just the circumstances. So there's always that residual collateral damage that happens from prior bad management or instability, which the Mets had. You saw it. We talked about the Knicks in the Open. They had instability for 2 decades. Now they have stability. Now, does that mean the decisions work out and that they win a championship? We'll see. Some could argue that maybe on that front, they made some wrong decisions the last 12 months. We'll see. Let's see where all this takes the Mets. So here's the plan. Subway Series next weekend. Obviously a late Sunday game, so we'll figure out the Sunday show. But Thursday on the day off, part two, David Mills, contributor to the Talking Mets Beyond the Mic newsletter, premium content, will be joining me again. Will he join me? You'll hear part two. Lot to get into on the pitching. Jonah Tong with a near-perfect game this weekend. Nolan McClain starting to make noise and knocking on the door at AAA. What about Brandon Sproat? Is he still the apple of everyone's eye? Or should he be the apple of everyone's eye? And what other names are out there? Pitching's the name of the game. And the Mets have done a good job importing pitchers and making maybe, you know, lemonade out of lemons, or supposedly lemons. Maybe they were a little bit better than lemons. So we'll see. we'll see what comes out of our conversation with David, and it should be interesting. Again, if you're listening, you could go to the link in the show and actually read the top positional prospects, and you'll also be able to do that on Thursday for a part two. Just, you know, go into the description. You'll see the link for the actual article by David. He goes into his top 15, honorable mentions, really, really good stuff. All right. I want to thank everybody for tuning in to this latest edition of the Talking Mets podcast. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. You get me on X at Talking Mets, no G, and in your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com, no G. Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. You get me on Instagram, TalkingMetsNoG. And of course, we'd love for you to subscribe to the newsletter, Substack.com/@TalkingMetsNoG. And I want to thank the good folks on the Fansided Podcasting Network for supporting this show. I'm your host, Mike Silva. Enjoy the rest of your weekend. We'll be back on Thursday with part two, Mets top pitching prospects. Till then, take care, everybody. For the